Stephen Sondheim wrote the role of Beetle Bamford with you in mind to play it. How did you and Sondheim first hook up?
Well, I just auditioned like everybody else. The story on the role is that he was not sure whether or not he really wanted a tenor or a basso. He just wanted a strange voice. And I thought that he probably was going to want to write a lot of crazy stuff, so I learned a lot of very crazy stuff for the auditions.
Like what?
I did a Ned Roram song. I did an Ives Art song in French. I did Since I Fell for You.
That's great.
And some other rock. So I did three, and a Mozart or a Handel aria or something.
What kind of voice did you sing Since I Fell for You in?
Just a bluesy rock thing.
So he knew that he wanted you for the role. Do you think that his hearing of your voice in his mind when he was writing the piece affected the way the pieces were written?
Yes, I think after I was cast, I mean, they asked me what I could do, and so I wrote him a long letter before we really got into the rehearsal period and just told him everything about my voice.
What do you tell people when you tell them about your voice?
I told him that I had really high notes, if he wanted to exploit that, and that from a certain range I could sound like Peter Pears, and another range I'd sound like Jussi Björling for about two notes. And, you know, I just told him what I thought of it and where I thought I would really show and in what way.
Do you want to describe the role of the Beetle?
Oh, he was a creep. He was an assistant henchman, and he really did all the dirty work for the judge.
And the judge, you want to describe the judge?
The judge was sort of your basic oily barrister type with black robes. And
there's a great scene in Sweeney Todd in which you perform, and we're going to hear this from the cast album in a moment. And this occurs at the height of the suspense. Sweeney Todd, who's the barber who has been killing his clients and then baking them into pies with his accomplice, is about to be discovered. Everything's about to be found out. Everything's falling apart. And then you come in as the Beetle because there's a strange smell in the air. The smell is actually these bodies being baked
right.
in the ovens. So at this height of this tension, when they're about to be discovered, perhaps by you, there's this comedic moment in the play. Can you talk about what that's like to completely change the mood and break the tension as the tension builds?
This is a controversial spot. In the tour, I only did the Broadway run, and on the tour, Hal Prince cut those songs because he always had disliked them. And for that reason, he thought that it slowed things down at the wrong moment. But what Steve had always really wanted to do was a trio for Mrs. Lovett and the Beetle and Tobias, and it would be the old Poison switch. You know, your glass would have poison, and you would switch the glass. And he wanted to do that, but he really couldn't. He didn't ever really get time to rewrite it. He's threatened to substitute a sequence like that in the upcoming revivals, but I haven't heard if that's really happening. So I was aware that it was an intrusion, but it was such a gas to do the moment. I mean, they're hilarious little songs. And Angela was a dream to be with there. She was the most giving actress that one can imagine. And it was like a tennis match every night.
Well, I want to play this recording with you and Angela Lansbury. Do you want to set it up a little more before we hear it?
As you say, I have come to investigate the stench in the air, which is these corpses being burned and turned into pies. It really sounds grisly, but it's pulled off with a great sort of panache, and so you don't really mind until it's over. But I've come to check it out, and she's very panicky because she's aware of everything that's going on and is involved in it herself. And so I see her new pump organ, which she's bought, and I sit down and start playing these little folk songs, and she can't get me out of the house.
Okay, well, let's hear it. And this is my guest, Jack Eric Williams, along with Angela Lansbury from the original cast recording of Sweeney Todd.
Sweet honey blanket lay in the grass, turned her eyes heavenward sighing. I am a lass who, alas, loves a lad who, alas, has a lass in Canterbury. Tis a row, dow, diddle, dow, day. Tis a row, dow, diddle, dow, dee.
Oh, Beetle Bamford, I didn't know you was a music lover too.
Well, when I saw this dear old songbook, I couldn't resist.
Sweet Polly Plunkett saw her knife pass, flew down the city road crying, I am a lass who, alas, loves a lad who, alas, has a lass, loves another lad. Who once I heard in Canterbury, tis a row-dow-diddle-dow-day, tis a row-dow-diddle-dow-dee. Well, ma'am, I hope you have a few moments. You see, there's been complaints.
Complaints?
It's about the stink from your chimney. Just a routine inspection, of course. Ah, one of Mother's favorites. If one bell rings in our tower of Bray, ding dong, your true love will stay. Ding dong, one bell today in the tower of Bray. Ding dong. Anyway, ma'am, health regulations being my duty, I'm afraid I'll have to ask you to let me take a look.
At the bakehouse?
That's right, ma'am.
Oh, but it's locked, you see, and I don't have the key. Mr. Todd, he's got the key, and he's not here right now.
When will he be back?
Oh, I couldn't say, I'm sure.
Then we'll just have to wait for him, won't we? But if two bells ring in our tower of Bray, ding dong, ding dong, your true love will stray. Ding dong, ding dong, two bells today in the
tower of Bray. Ding dong, ding dong.
What's that?
Oh, that's just the lad what helps me with the pies.
But surely he's in the bakehouse then, isn't he?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, of course. But you see, last week he ran off, and we found him 2 days later down by the embankment, half-starved, poor thing. So ever since then, we locks him in for his own security. Oh, do have a try at the third bell. It always touches my heart.
If three bells ring in our tower of Bray... Oh, since you're a fellow music lover, ma'am, why not raise your voice along with mine?
Oh, all right.
A ding dong.
Ding dong.
Ding dong. Your love's gone away. Ding dong.
Ding dong.
Ding dong. Three bells today in the tower of Bray. Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. If four bells ring,
how many bells are there?
12. Ding dong.
Ding dong.
That was my guest, Jack Eric Williams, in the role of Beetle Bamford in Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, singing along with Angela Lansbury. And Jack Eric Williams has written an opera called Mrs. Farmer's Daughter about Frances Farmer that's currently being performed by the American Music Theater Festival at the Trocadero Theater, and we'll be talking about that opera in a few minutes. Well, you had said that one of the things you pointed out to Sondheim about your voice when he was writing this part was that you could reach a lot of high notes. It seems to me he certainly made use of that in those last few ding-dongs.
Yes, he raised very, very high. There's lots of Ds and several Bs and stuff. And you have to have a very supple top to do it and to keep it together. It's very difficult to do. It's lovely.
Did you ever miss any of the ding-dongs?
Oh, sure, right and left.
But I guess in a situation like that, it's okay because it's the Beatle missing it. Like, the Beatle would probably miss it, too.
You have to justify it some way, as I recall.
When you were working on Sweeney Todd, were there any contradictions between what Sondheim wanted and what Hal Prince wanted, who directed it?
I don't know that I would call them contradictions. I think that Sondheim is much more, was in this piece, much more interested in just entertaining. And I think you may be referring to an anecdote. There was one afternoon in the balcony of the Eurus. Prince was working on something on the stage, and Sondheim was in the balcony. And I went up and said, well, what's the ending going to be like? And he said, oh, I don't know. I said, are we going to get a big moral? And he said, well, you know, Hal is a big fan of Brecht and Meyerhold, and he said, I'm strictly Joan Crawford, so I really would prefer not. But he would like to have left it at a fairy tale, and I think it was Prince's doing that made it into sort of a morality statement.
there are people who came back to see Sweeney Todd 5, 10, 15, 20 times. Were you aware of their presence? Would they come backstage afterwards?
Yes. They were very ardent fans and very, very devoted. And they were at the stage door a lot and sent us a lot of notes and presents. And they made their presence known. I think that many people really felt that the show was important to the future of theater and that it was important to them personally, that they had been addressed in some way with the show.
Do you enjoy having fans like that?
Oh, of course. It's the only fan to have. All the rest of people are not fans. They're just admirers.
My guest is Jack Eric Williams, who's performed in Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd and in the Richard Foreman-directed production of the Threepenny Opera. And he has an opera that he's written currently performed in Philadelphia called Mrs. Farmer's Daughter. It's about actress Frances Farmer. It's being performed by the American Music Theater Festival and is currently in production at the Trocadero Theater and continues through Sunday. Do you think that your work on two, I think, really brilliant musicals, the Threepenny Opera and Sweeney Todd, affected what you wanted out of the opera that you were writing about Frances Farmer?
I certainly hope so. Yes, of course. I mean, I'm not very impressed with most musicals or most theater, like most people, I think. I mean, people who love the theater go a lot hoping to be knocked out. It happens very infrequently. And along the way, you just hope that you can learn something so that you can, maybe when you get the chance, you can do something that you might like yourself. And from that standpoint, I've certainly tried to learn from all my experience, but the two major things I've done in New York happen to have been wonderful shows. You know, I feel very lucky in that I have not been in a lot of very disappointing shows, because I think it's important for an artist to keep his or her ideals high, and whatever that means, not that you're stainless or blameless, but that you try to keep your nose clean so that you don't get tempted to do all the wrong things, which is very easy to do. And I've been very lucky to be associated with wonderful people who knew exactly what they wanted and what they were doing.
What did the life of Frances Farmer intrigue you?
I think that there's a little bit of Frances Farmer in everybody, and I think that it's sort of a state of mind in a way. I think that America has gotten very opinionated, like Frances Farmer got very opinionated. And I think that America has made a lot of mistakes that Frances Farmer made, taking itself too seriously, giving itself too much credit for knowing it all, and the whole sort of social problems that this country has with other countries and the world at large, I think, were the same problems that Frances Farmer had with her own life, with her contemporaries. And that's the main thing that I think interests me, is the aspect of getting along, which she was simply unable to master. And that's what's kept me with it, I think.
What source material did you use, since there's some pretty contradictory tellings of her story that exist now?
Right. Well, of course, I've read everything that I could. There's three major books. There's Shadowland by William Arnold, and the first book was Will There Really Be a Morning, which was ghostwritten by Genera Ratcliffe, her latter-day companion, and what is called an autobiography. And then there's Edith Farmer Elliott's Look Back in Love, which is the sister describing and trying to defend Frances really against these other books and other rumors and allegations. I, of course, have read everything I could, and there's an enormous amount in print, really, if you start to look. This particular project is very fortunate to have as its researcher Joseph Stockdale, who not only knew Frances Farmer quite well for the last 8 years of her life, but directed her in three major stage productions, her last three legitimate stage productions in Indianapolis, at Purdue, when she lived in Indianapolis. And Joe was really responsible for helping her fulfill her dreams as an actress. She has written him a letter in her own hand in which she attributes her final success in her own estimation to him, to his directing. And so Joe has the largest collection of Farmerana I can imagine, and he has done a lot of very unique research. He's pulled other people who knew her there, students and people who worked with her, and just has everything. And so we've been able to pull together a very accurate, I think, picture of what she was really like. The problem with the movie and Will There Really Be a Morning, the TV thing, really were that they were incomplete. If they simply had told the whole story, even with errors and things, you would have forgiven them, but they stopped 20 years short of the end of her life, or 10 or 15 at the least. And she, the most interesting part of her life, of course, is the last part, when you see what all this really has added up to, what kind of a human being has emerged from this. And that's what our show has that none of the other projects have.
Can you talk a little bit about that part of her life?
It's better seen than talked about, I think, but it's just a normal life. That's the extraordinary part about it, is that nothing happens. Nothing happens. I mean, she has horrible and wonderful things that happen to her, but there's no big payoff.
There's been a lot of controversy about how political she really was, mm-hmm. and how much her left-wing politics affected her, the demise of her career in Hollywood. What do you think? Do you think she was very serious politically?
And no,
do you think
that, not at all.
That affected her work?
I don't think she was serious at all. I think she was in the wrong place at the right time or something. For a while, it was very fashionable to be this or that. And I think she got caught up in the idea that all of the really hip people, the group theater and Odets and all of his contemporaries that were in her life at that time, really knew what they were doing. And she just bought it hook, line, and sinker. And she went out and spoke for them and lent her signature and her name to things that their names never appeared on. Hardly ever do you see Harold Clurman or Clifford Odets' name on anything, but Frances Farmer's everywhere, simply because she thought it was the right thing to do. But it was an act of self-immolation in a sense. Although the problems that she had were not really directly political, they were indirectly political. She placed herself in a certain position and then paid for it sort of under the table instead of overtly. No one said, oh, Frances Farmer is a political enemy. They said she's incorrigible.
Do you think that her manner with people also affected her career?
Absolutely. That's the main problem, is that she didn't know how to coexist with other people. She really didn't. And she ultimately, I think, realizes that, but too late.
Did you do any research into what mental institutions were like at the time she was institutionalized?
Not really. I pretty much take it from her, you know, her descriptions of what went on, and knowing what I know, but I have not done an extensive amount of research about it. I just simply take her word for it. Sounds pretty bad.
There are some people who write plays or novels about somebody who existed, and they find as they get deeper into it that they really don't like the person. Did that ever happen to you with Frances Farmer?
Well, it's definitely a love-hate relationship. I find her very compelling, and there's the way her life cancels itself out at every opportunity. She goes left, and then she goes right, and then she's nowhere. And then that happens through the whole life. It's just a constant series of obliterations. And I think that's fascinating. And the fact that we don't know about her, we haven't until recently, and that she's an American, and a sort of, it creates almost an American psychosis, you know. I mean, I think that it's much more extraordinary story than James Dean or any of these other things that we've heard about. I think this is the story. If you want a capsulized American trauma, this is it.
The music that you've written for this opera about Frances Farmer draws on a wide range of American music. What was your intention in using so many different styles for the score?
I suppose, in a way, just to blow it out and do everything I knew how to do. I think the story is so crazy that to try to tone it down and give it a coloration doesn't seem quite right. It seems like almost a theatrical simplicity or something. Like you try to... The problems with the story are making sense of it, in a sense. As soon as you try to ascribe logic to it, it falls apart and evaporates. And I felt that the same thing would probably be true by trying to really be unified in tone. I thought the best way to tell this crazy story is crazily.
Did you ever consider writing a role for yourself in it?
No, I didn't. Since Sweeney, I have wanted to concentrate on the writing. And it's been, I do want to perform again, there are times when I feel very itchy about it, but I've gone on a diet from performing early. I feel like it turned me, it made people have difficulty taking me seriously as a writer. As long as I was involved, wanting to perform, people thought, oh, he just wants to show off, you know. So I want to show off in a different way, so I've tried to bow out for a while.
How involved were you with the direction of it, hearing your score performed? Did you want to do line readings for everybody
always,
and tell them exactly how to do it?
Always. I'm afraid that it's very difficult, particularly on this piece, I think. I think because you have to know her story in order to know why the music and so on down the line. You have to really understand all the paradoxes in it. And I am usually one of the only people who really understands all of it, or at least what I meant by it. And so it is a constant temptation to harangue, which is not admirable. But in this case, it's like, no, she didn't do that. That's not what happened. It was over here. So from that standpoint, I think this has more problems for me that way. It's not so much that I'm possessive of what I've written. It's just that when the story gets all screwed around, which it sometimes does, it's very frustrating.
So you have to stand back because you're not the director?
I'm not the director, no. I just have tried to be a good boy this time.
But you were playing in the band, in the orchestra the night I
right.
saw you.
I was trying to establish tempos. We had a lot of difficulty with the orchestrations. There were a lot of mix-up in the parts. And so we had, the band was very under-rehearsed for the first couple of nights, and I thought it best for me to play just to keep it straight. I'm not sure that I did any good, but it kept me out of trouble.
So how does it feel for you now to see this opera that you've worked on, I imagine, for several years, staged?
It's good. This is not a perfect rendition of the piece. The piece is very complicated, but this is a very, very fulfilling rendition. I think that the audiences are enjoying it very much, by and large. And it's such a difficult piece. It really needs to go into workshop for like 6 weeks or 6 months or something like that and really have all the bugs ironed out of it because it's so complicated. But the material is talented material, I think. And the cast is wonderful. And Michael Vita, who is responsible for a lot of the staging, did a great job. And George Ferens. It's been a good experience.
One last question. Since you're not really performing professionally much because you're spending most of your time writing, do you sing at home anyways?
Well, yes. I when I'm writing, I sing it all to make sure that it's singable. And try to figure out how it lies best for the voice. I try to give it the acid test and then write it down.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.